the nation of Israel regarding their unfaithfulness to him. And he even went so far as his prophecy what? Marry a wife of harlotry, or one who had been raised in an environment of harlotry, idolatry, sent to which God was going to get their attention, is pretty remarkable. He had sent prophets to them. He had appealed to them. He had warned them. He had told them how bad it was going to be when the punishment came, in an attempt to get them to turn around and stop doing what they were doing. Did they do that? No, they did not. And we'll see even more evidence of that in this chapter. Just as a brief summary, the book is broken up that the first three chapters really deals with the story of Hosea and his wife Gomer and the adultery that she committed. Chapters 4 through 13, kind of a fancy way of saying these were different discourses about what Israel had done and how God had been faithful. And then finally, the last chapter has to do with Israel's opportunity for restoration. And there's aspects of that, of how that would or could be fulfilled. For the chapters I've already studied, because I'm going to try to cover four chapters tonight. That may be aggressive, but we'll try to do that. Chapters, again, and I'm not catching up with my charts here. You can see God paid attention to what was going on. They just commit these things and God be oblivious to it and allow things just to continue without doing something about it. True for us today. Same as the nation today. The judgment of God was coming. The different things about last week. I'd like for us to go to chapter 11 now. I think we did chapters 9 and 10. I want you to look at chapter 11. When Israel was a child, I loved him. Out of Egypt, I called my son. They had been in slavery, had they not? The more they recalled, the more they went away. They kept sacrificing to Baals and burning offerings to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took him up by their arms. I did not know that they did not know that I healed them. Remember that Ephraim, the largest tribe, is sometimes used as a representative of all of Israel. Sometimes it is specific to Israel, to Ephraim. Sometimes it is more, Ephraim represents the entire tribe. I led them with cords of kindness, with bands of love. And we won't notice every verse for time constraints. It says, they shall not return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria shall be their king, because they have refused to return to me. The Assyrians were about to invade and take this northern tribe, northern nation of Israel away. And they were going to basically be assimilated into that nation and to never return. The sword shall raise against their cities, consume the bars of their gates, and devour them because of their own counsels. My people are bent on turning away from me. And though they call out to the Most High, he shall not raise them up at all. There is a point that we can reach that it's too far. God has a limit on what he will endure in us. And there is a point where they were going to reach, but there was no turning back. Look at verse 8. But even in the midst of this, God still has this emotional appeal for these people. The very people, the very nation that he picked out, these people, that this current nation of Israel, are descendants, right? They are the descendants of that initial group of people that were called out of Egypt, that go all the way back to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. Even in the midst of trouble with my computer, and I lost my charts on chapter 11, or I deleted them, not realizing it. I didn't have time to recreate them. So I hope you'll just bear with me to get to chapter 12. He says, I will not execute my burning anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not a man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath. They shall go after the Lord. He will roar like a lion. When he roars, his children shall come trembling from the west. They shall come trembling like birds from Egypt and like dust from the land of Assyria. Then he says, Ephraim has surrounded me with lies and the house of Israel with deceit. But Judah still walks with God and is faithful to the Holy One. So which of the two nations were taken away? The nation of Israel, on the throne, his kingdom reigns on the throne in heaven today. He is a physical descendant of the nation of Judah, right? From the lineage of David. His lineage can be traced all the way back to Adam, of course. Chapter 12. Ephraim feeds on the wind and pursues the east wind all day long. What does Ecclesiastes say about wind and the wind? It's fruitless, vanity. Trying to grab the wind. What good is that? And it says here, I think similar idea. Ephraim feeds on the wind and pursues the east wind all day long. That east wind is supposedly the wind that came out of the Arabian desert and was considered to be not just unbeneficial, it was considered to be injurious to crops. It would have been, I guess, a hot, dry wind. They're pursuing that. They multiply falsehood and violence. They make a covenant with Assyria, and oil is carried to Egypt. It is believed that the reference here of multiplying falsehood and violence, in particular, has to do with aspects of the idolatry that they were engaged in at that time. The Lord has an indictment against Judah. Not only is the nation of Israel, of course, the nation of Israel had no righteous king whatsoever, did they? None of them. If you look, you remember how the Bible kind of depicts each king and says he did evil or he did what was right. A few kings, of course, it is said that they did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. But that is never said of one of the kings of Israel. But he says he still has an indictment against Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. Interesting to note here, he says he will punish Jacob. Think about Jacob. At the very beginning of Jacob's life and his birth, what is it said of Jacob? What was he doing as he was born? He had his hand on his heel, and that was indicative of the kind of life that he would live, in a sense, that he was a planter. He was one that was grabbing, I guess, in a sense, to pull ahead. It is saying here that was somewhat representative of his pursuit of God, I think. He took his brother by the heel, and in his manhood he strove with God. What's that talking about? Striving with God. This is later on in his life. Wrestle with an angel. What was he demanding of that angel? I'm not going to let you go till you do what? Somebody said it. Yeah, a blessing. Give me a blessing. He recognized the importance of being blessed by God. He strove with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He met God at Bethel. What did God say to Abraham? What did he say to Jacob at Bethel? You remember something he told him that he had already told his father and grandfather? Exactly. That threefold promise. Land, nation, and seed. Huh? Changed his name to Israel, father of many nations. So, Bethel. Well, I think what he's pointing there is a in a sense that he is recognizing that Jacob saw the importance of pursuing a relationship with God. He's using that maybe in a sense to compel the Israelites or the nation of Israel to do the same. The Bible makes a point here about Jehovah. Well, let me go back just a little bit. Look at verse. Ephraim has said, but I am rich. I have found wealth for myself. Again, Ephraim being somewhat representative of the entire northern nation. In all my labors, they cannot find in me iniquity or sin. This is what God says. I am the Lord your God from the land of Egypt. I will again make you dwell in tents as in the day of the appointed feast. I spoke to the prophets. It was I who multiplied visions and through the prophets gave parables. If there is iniquity in Gilead, they shall surely come to nothing. In Gilgal they sacrifice bulls. Their altars are also like stone heaps on the furrows of a field. It says, Jacob fled from the land of Aram or Syria, and there Israel served for a wife. For a wife he guarded sheep. By a prophet the Lord brought Israel up from Egypt, and by a prophet he was guarded. Then he talks about Ephraim again. He has given bitter provocation, so his Lord will leave his blood guilt on him and will repay him for his graceful deeds. God was keeping a record of what the people were doing, the nation of Israel was doing. And he's drawing a contrast, again, between what Jacob did and what the nation of Israel did. The idea of false balances. They become like the Canaanites. Look at verse. My version says a merchant, but what if some of your versions say there instead of a merchant? A Canaanite. So basically, they had lived among these people and they were starting to behave like these people, were they not? False balances. They were cheating others. He loves to oppress, but again, this idea that we just read already. I'm rich. I've found wealth. And all my labors, they cannot find in me iniquity or sin. An idea here that God still plans to restore Israel. We can see that as we read just a minute ago. I will make you dwell in tents in the days of the appointed feast. Now, there are differences of opinion regarding how much of these prophecies are messianic or Christ related versus how much of these prophecies are directly related to their restoration. So maybe their fulfillment. Time. We'll talk about that a little later in one of the other chapters. Trying to cover so many chapters, it's hard to keep all my thoughts together. But let's move on. The wicked pursuits of Gilead and Gilgal. There is iniquity in Gilead. They shall surely come to nothing. In Gilgal, they sacrifice bulls. Again, this would be in reference, I believe, to idolatrous type of worship. Their altars are also like stone heaps. Again, it is basically come to nothing. What they're doing comes to nothing. What is the New Testament equivalent? What does the Bible say is idolatry in the New Testament of us, our pursuits for material things, our covetousness? What will come of it? What will it ultimately pay? Nothing. Nothing. It'll only be good for this limited amount of time of our existence in this life only. And then what good is it going to do in the eons of time after we are dead? Will not serve any. Some of these prophecies are admittedly a little hard to grasp. Sometimes it jumps around a little bit. Sometimes it's referring to Israel. And then it kind of says, it gives you a glimpse of restoration. So it's a little hard to follow. But the overall idea here is that God is not going to tolerate their idolatry and unfaithfulness. And that's really the whole point of the whole. Let's go to chapter 13. And again, Israel needs to be as determined to follow God as Jacob was determined to obtain Rachel from Laban. Was he pretty determined? Yeah. How long did he ultimately serve for her? 14 years. 7. Then his father-in-law tricked him and gave him Leah instead. And then, of course, he was given that. Worked 7 more years. 14 years. He was definitely in pursuit of her. He saw value in her. Chapter 13. Oh God, and it's to be repaid. Look at the very first part of chapter 13. When Ephraim spoke, there was trembling. He was exalted in Israel. What does that mean? What do you think that means? When you remember that commercial when E.F. Hutton talks, people commercial. I think it was E.F. Hutton. And he would, the commercial with, I don't remember exactly how it went, but the point was when the E.F. Hutton person talked, everything stopped and people listened. It was a very popular commercial. I think they're a financial group of some sort. Ephraim spoke, there was trembling. He was exalted in Israel. There was a time when Ephraim, and I think in this case, this is more representative of the tribe of Ephraim, more so among the other nations than being more representative of just of the entire nation. But he incurred guilt through Baal and died. Now they sin more and more and make themselves metal images, idols skillfully made of their silver, all of craftsmen. Instead of them, and again, there's a little bit different in variations of how this verse is interpreted, but I think the idea here is there are men who are offering sacrifices who kiss calves. Calves. These people, out of Egypt by God, told not to be idolaters, and what are they doing? They're serving Baal, and some of these gods that they served, that they have been influenced to serve by the people around them, was some of the most wicked and sensual type of worship that you can imagine. And they engaged in these kind of things strictly, primarily because they've been influenced by the people around them to do it. And here's this nation that had respect among the other tribes, this tribe of Ephraim. And now he no longer has any respect. You ever seen that happen in a person's life? I mean, there's lots of things we can draw out of this that are applicable to us. A person is a very spiritual type of influence that they had at one time. And so has been the case here with Ephraim. And even going to the extent that they are kissing these calves, these idols. Therefore they shall be like the morning mist or like the dew that goes early away, like the chaff that swirls from the fresh threshing floor or like smoke from a window. Have you ever been driving home, maybe from work or driving in town and look and see smoke billowing off in the distance and you think, well, something's burning. Is it a house or is it a field fire or tires or what? Drive back 3 or 4 hours later. Most of the time, do you even remember that it was there? Or the dew. Sometimes when I get up really early in the morning, the other day, taking the recycle out, now, and dripped back, and where he had walked from the car, there were steps from when he had walked the night before, when he had come in the night before, the dew had fallen all around. Well, my afternoon, that dew is gone. And that's what he is likening them to. Like the chaff that swirls from the fish in the Syrians. But I am the Lord your God from the land of Egypt. You know no God but me. and besides me there is no Savior. God had been a constant with them since He brought them out of Egypt. What were they in Egypt? Slaves. Mistreated. Made to work. They were crying out to God. Now, I didn't supposed to. When the time came, God acted. He appointed Moses. He brought them up out of Egypt. Did they seem to appreciate that as a whole? No. They complained. But God was active. You know, they were, was it 400 years they were in? It was I who knew you in the wilderness and the land of drought. But when they had grazed, they became full. They were filled. And their heart was lifted up. I guess I don't need to turn around. I can see it back there. You know, it seems as though these verses are suggesting what? This is verse 6. What is this suggesting? Yeah. They had been blessed materially. An argument that we're probably in the one of, maybe the most materially rich nations on the earth. And a lot of times when you live in that kind of situation, you forget where these blessings come from. It seems to me a lot of the, I agree, Andy. I think we've reached a point, culture has reached a point where they don't recognize their dependence upon God. We have become so rich, and we, as a nation, have forgotten God to a point of practicing homosexual like that, and it is outrageous that people would consider such a person. It is total of the God of heaven. And people don't realize they are a being more powerful than we can ever imagine, who created the world, who made the world, who can be judged for it. And we'll be judged for it if we go along with it. Just that we've reached this point. So there's lots of lessons in this. And these Israelites were engaging in these things too. Okay, these pagan nations and the fertility gods that they worshipped, the sexual sin was very much part of it. And that's probably one reason it was so appealing to them, is that they caught up in it. Putting your trust in something other than God, you're putting it in something that is not going to pay off. It's not going to pay off. The world doesn't even pretend to offer anything beyond this life. When they therefore they forgot me. And look at what it says God is going to be to them. So I then I am like a leopard, I will lurk beside the way. I have never seen a bear out in the wild. I have been told if you go up to the Smokies and you see a bear, particularly one who is like a female bear with her cubs, you better be careful because she will protect her cub. And that's what it is likening God's response. I will fall upon them like a bear robbed of her cubs. I will tear open the breast. I will devour them like a lion, as a wild beast would rip them open. It sounds tough, doesn't it? And people have a hard time with this. They say, well, how could God be that harsh? What else could He do? He had prophet after prophet warning and appealing to them. What else was going to work? He had to reach this point. He had to appeal to them this way. Nothing else was going to work with them. He destroys you, O Israel, for you are against me, against your helper. Where now is your king? to save you in your all your cities. Where are your rulers, all your rulers? What did they ask for in the days of Samuel the prophet? They wanted a king. They wanted to be like the other nations. We talked about this last lesson. They want to be like the other nations. Where is your king? Those of whom you said, give me a king and princes. He allowed them and took them away. The iniquity of Ephraim is bound up. His sin is kept in store. The pangs of childbirth come for him, but he is like an unwise son. And there's sort of an odd poetic view here. He is likening this nation to a child that is about to be born but can't be. And it's almost as if the child, and of course we know in regular anatomy and biology that it is not the child's fault if it can't be born, but in a poetic, figurative sense, he is likening this to a child who is responsible for not being born, right? Again, I don't think we need to get too caught up in the anatomical and biological aspects of whether or not that could actually be true, but he is using it in a representative way to say that. For at the right time, he does not present himself at the opening of the womb. Again, like he is responsible. I shall ransom them from the power of Sheol. Now we're changing direction here. Power of Sheol, the idea of death. You remember, you see these dual states, we talked about this last class, parallelism, I think scholars call it. I shall ransom them from the power of Sheol. I shall redeem them from death. Again, it's the same idea being repeated twice. O death, where are your plagues? O Sheol, where is your sting? That sounds familiar. Not in 1 Corinthians. Compassion is hidden from my eyes. Though he may flourish among his brothers, the east wind, the wind of the Lord shall come, rising from the wilderness, and his fountain shall dry up. Remember that east wind we talked about at first from the Arabian desert? A dry, parching type of wind. It shall strip his treasury of every precious thing. Samaria shall bear her guilt, because she has rebelled against her God. They shall fall by the sword, their little ones shall be dashed in pieces, and their pregnant women ripped open. Pretty serious stuff. Well, talked about the child and the birth process, yet God would still ransom them from death. But the nation of Israel and Samaria would fall. We know for certain that happened. When did that happen? Let's look at chapter 14. Kind of an ending here. Return, Israel, to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. Return, return. Take with you words and return to the Lord. Look at what he tells him to say. Say to him, take away all iniquity, accept what is good, and we will pay with bulls the vows of our lips. Assyria or Ashur, some versions say. The idea here of Ashur goes back to the Assyrians that were descendants of one of the sons of Shem. Remember Shem, Ham, and Japheth? The earth was populated through those three people, right? And I've even read there's DNA evidence to suggest that they indicate that people today are all descended from one of three main DNA lines. Assyria won't save. We will not ride on horses. The idea about not riding on horses, I'm going to tell you if they're in the chart. Who went to Egypt to get horses? Solomon. In direct violation of what God said about multiplying horses, he multiplied horses. So I think there's a reference there to Egypt. And we will say no more, our God, well, we will no longer say to work of our hands, our God. All right? Take a molten metal and make out of it a god, or take a tree and fashion it some way, make a god out of it and call it our God. In you, the orphan finds mercy. I will heal their apostasy. I will love them freely, for my anger is turned from them. I will be like the dew to Israel. He shall blossom like the lily. Big change of pace here. He shall take root like the trees of Lebanon. His shoots shall spread out. His beauty shall be like the olive, and his fragrance like Lebanon. They shall return and dwell beneath my shadow. They shall flourish like the grain. They shall blossom like the vine. Their fame shall be like the wine of Lebanon. O Ephraim, what do I have to do with idols? It is I who answer and look to you. There are different translations there in verse 8. Some are saying as if Ephraim will finally say, what do I have to do with idols? It depends on, I'm reading from the English Standard Version. I am like an evergreen cypress. From me comes your fruit. Remember the idea we talked about? What did we say that Ephraim meant? Whoever is wise, let him understand these things. Whoever is discerning, let him know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the upright walk in them, but transgressors stumble in them. And God is finally appealing to them. And there is a belief, if you read one commentator, they believe that some of this, maybe there's a dual fulfillment here. This is a sense that God is appealing to them, to even though He has said, here's all these bad things can happen, are going to happen, He still appeals to them in the hope that maybe they still will return. That's evidence of the compassion that God has. Some people also believe that perhaps some of this is messianic, has to do with the kingdom of people of Israel, descendants of them, having the opportunity to be saved that way. So there may be a dual fulfillment here as well through the kingdom of Christ. These analogies come true, right? Again, some of the things we just talked, let the wise discern. That sort of sounds like Proverbs, doesn't it? You know, even if this wasn't inspired literature, it's a beautiful literature. The writings of Hosea, these discourses, just the way that it expresses it. Well, here are some concluding thoughts, and Steve may want to go back and make some. You know, God asked Hosea to go and marry this woman to represent to them just exactly what they were doing to him. And I imagine for a prophet, that would have been a pretty scandalous thing, even in that day, even in the midst of a culture that pretty much accepted anything. And this book shows just how long-suffering and merciful God is, but God is also a just God. And again, as we pointed out earlier, the Bible says the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. People choose not to believe in God. They choose to ignore abundant evidence for His reality that He does exist. And to imagine being on the opposite side of that God. See, they had reached a point, they had become so satisfied in life, they didn't care. They were engaged in idolatry and whatever pleasure, whatever benefit they felt like that brought to them. And they had just pushed God aside. Which is what, again, our nation is doing. But the point that we come back to in this book, and I think chapter 14 shows this, even if we make a disaster of our lives, even like this nation had made a disaster out of its relationship with Him, and maybe we've reached a low point in life where we think we can't climb out, God is still willing and still loving, and still caring, and still wanting us to come back to Him, just like He was this nation. Any comments? I've done a bunch of talking. I won't do justice to. I mean, Jesus used the language with respect. There was another point I was going to make, and I don't remember what it was. So maybe Steve will think about it and make it next week. I hope everybody heard really well. So seems like they got it all adjusted pretty well. I appreciate your comments.